Our next case for argument this morning is United States against Villasenor. And where is Mr. Lopez? Well, this is a puzzle. I had thought Mr. Lopez had signed in this morning. Clerk's office staff is trying to find him. I hope he hasn't fallen down an elevator shaft.
I hope not.
On his way will not cut it. Mr. Getter.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it please the Court, Matthew Getter on behalf of the United States. Judge, there are four issues that the defense has raised in this case, and I would take them in order.
Here he is.
Would Your Honor like me to...
Mr. Lopez?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez, you were instructed to be here at 10 o'clock. This is not 10 o'clock.
I know, Judge. There was a Dearborners mess.
That's why you have to come before 10 o'clock in order to be sure that you are here at 10 o'clock. It is your professional responsibility.
Thank you, sir. I really apologize to the Court.
Your Honor, for the record, Joseph Lopez on behalf of the defendant, appellant. On this case, Your Honors, what we had here was a general overall charge of a conspiracy. We had a series of wholesalers in this case and a series of retailers in this case. We had another issue in this case that I think is kind of important and is probably kind of a unique situation. I don't think the Seventh Circuit's ever addressed this. And that is the status of Carlos Villasenor as being the informant. Carlos Villasenor was a member of a group of people that worked out of Mexico to Texas. Carlos Villasenor, Your Honors, also hooked up with the DEA. As a DEA informant, Your Honors, he would lack the intent. And I think this is important for the Court to take into consideration. When you have a person working as an informant who's working both sides of the coin, as we did in this case, what you have here is a person who lacks the intent generally to commit the crime. I think what's more important that the Court can consider, Your Honors, is the fact that, and I think this is another important factor the Court taking into consideration, as the defendant was given, Mr. Villasenor was given a 5K1 departure. The 5K1 departure given by the government was for his cooperation in this investigation. And if you remember in the record, too, we have the issue of Wilfredo Rodriguez, who was another wholesaler based out of Texas. Mr. Wilfredo Rodriguez, Your Honors, was also targeted by Mr. Carlos Villasenor. And I think more importantly, too, Your Honors, is Mahin Villasenor and Wilfredo Rodriguez did business together at least on one occasion.
Well, I thought Carlos gave the DEA help regarding Rodriguez, but didn't give any help concerning the conspiracy in which he participated.
Well, When there was an investigation going on, the way DEA does these investigations is they hook up an informant. They usually provide a telephone or some means of communicating. So what happened was Wilfredo Rodriguez and Carlos Villasenor were discussing drug transactions. And that is true. The information given by Carlos Villasenor was in regard to Wilfredo Rodriguez. But at the same time, he was engaged in other sales with other people. And as a, I guess his get out of jail card was his cooperation agreement, because he was given a 5K1 even in this case. So what I think is, and I looked for other cases, and I didn't really see anything that was in particular to this case, is when is an informant really an informant and when is he really not an informant? I guess that's the real issue. Can he switch the light on and off on one day, decide he's going to be an informant, on another day, decide he isn't going to be an informant? I think that has a question of his intent in this case. And in order to join a conspiracy, you have to have an agreement. So if he is an informant, can he really agree to participate in the conspiracy? Because at times he can and times he can't. So his agreement goes on and off. And it's an interesting question, because I haven't seen it addressed in any other particular areas or other circuits in this regard.
So wasn't it a timing issue in terms of when the conspiracy in this case was alleged versus all this other uncharged conduct or his cooperation with other defendants?
Well, there is an issue, but I think that once you become an informant, you're an informant forever. I don't think you can stop being an informant when you're working with DEA. I mean, DEA relies on these people to give them information. DEA has to rely on all the information. And again, it goes to the question of intent to join a conspiracy. Can you really be said to have an agreement with others if, and the question is if, you are already given information to handling agents? Because the essence of the conspiracy, this court has said over and over again, is the agreement. And again, especially in a drug conspiracy, the government doesn't have to put any drugs on the table in order to prove an agreement. And a conspiracy, all they have to do is prove that two people conspired. There's not even an overt act that's required. So the intent of the actor, I think, is important. The intent in regard to the agreement is very, very important, and it's something I think the court should take into consideration. And the other thing, too, is we had this issue with Mr. Harris. And Mr. Harris was the chemist in this case. Now, we had an interesting jury below. A very interesting jury. Gave us a mixed bag of tricks, basically. The jury found the defendant not guilty on three counts. So I think the court should take into consideration is this wasn't just a jury who sat idly and thought the evidence was overwhelming. One of these counts in which they found the defendant not guilty, there was testimony from surveillance agents, participants in it, and they still found him not guilty. So this jury was actually really looking at this particular prosecution with a fine-tooth comb. And not all juries do that downstairs. And I've done enough juries in this building to know some juries are quick to convict, others are quick to think about it. And that's just human nature, how people really are. And you can't control how people feel once they get into the building. And you can't control how they're going to deliberate. But when you have a jury that actually deliberated like this jury deliberated, I think the failure to disclose the impeaching evidence was critical to this case. And I'm not saying that the government hid this. I think that one of two things happened. One, Harris didn't tell the government during pretrial preparation, because prior to putting these witnesses on, the government does meet with them and does prepare them. And I have no reason to believe the government covered this up. I want that record to be clear. I've dealt with this with the U.S. attorney on this case for a long period of time, and I think that he was duped just as everybody else was duped. I don't think it came to his attention post-conviction. He didn't know about it, and maybe Harris didn't disclose it, and maybe he just didn't ask Harris about it. I'm not really sure what happened because I wasn't present. But one thing that we do know is the government relied on the test results in their closing argument. They relied on it during the trial, and they relied on his conclusion. And his conclusion is something that we could have attacked had we been given this information. Inattention to duty, failure to label exhibits properly. I mean, these are critical issues that go to the overall inquiry in this case. Did the government prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt? And that's really what it went to. I know the cases here in this district and several other districts is basically you know, tell us why you think the jury would have done something different, even though we don't really have the proof by preponderance of the evidence to come up with that. But tell me, and sitting as appellate court, you know, Mr. Lopez, well, how would it have made a difference? And here's how I think it would have made a difference, Your Honors. Would have made a difference, one, to Mr. Mendez's attorney, which I'm not Mr. Mendez's attorney, but two, to the overall strength of the prosecution's case, the overall strength of the prosecution's case. Come in here. You are not the jury, but I could argue to the jury. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you heard about this chemist. You heard about the sloppy work that this chemist performed. You heard about his inattention to duty. These are all the factors that go to whether the government has proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Would it have altered the effect? I don't know. I don't know. The one case that we have here in the district with Judge Holderman granted a new trial based on the I think it's the Baker case, because of an issue with the chemist with credit cards and some other things. It's a little bit different, but it still goes to the credibility of the chemist. And he found when he gave the
You didn't cite Bell in your brief. Now, of course, Bell wouldn't do you any good because the holding of Banks.
Banks, I'm sorry.
The holding of Banks was that the choice was within the district judge's discretion and could have been made and affirmed either way.
And
here the district court considered it, decided the other way, and, of course, the holding of Banks is that it would be confirmed either way.
I agree 100% with you. Unfortunately, a lot of the defendants at the MCC don't see it that way because they always cite that case as being an automatic proposition for a new trial. And the court is exactly right. The court could have or couldn't have.
Is this why you didn't cite it? Because we made it perfectly clear that if Judge Holderman had decided that case the other way, we would have affirmed that too.
I think you're right, Judge. I have to admit we didn't want to. We did raise it in response only because of the communications we received from the client. I agree with you. Judge Holderman found in his case that it made a difference. And in our case, Judge Gottschall didn't make a difference. And I wish I could hold Banks up and say, you know, Judge, here's the opinion right here. Give us a new trial. But I can't because, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook is completely correct on that point. And can I just
And let me just say, we know that the government, when they realized all this problem with the chemist, had the scale retested by a different chemist.
That is true.
Same result.
It did have the same result, but I don't really think that the inquiry is on the result as it is on the witness testifying. Just because it is, and it is, I think makes a difference when you're actually cross-examining a chemist and arguing to a jury. I mean, these cases are hard to begin with. I mean, these cases, the government's success rate in these conspiracy cases are just tremendous. And just one last thing is, the constructive possession of the weapon, Your Honors, the defendant was 1,600 miles away from the home. A third party entered the home. A third party opened the door because they had a search warrant. Third party opened the door. I know it was found in the master bedroom, but still we don't think it's enough because you can't show or the government couldn't show when the defendant was last at the premises, who else was in the premises, and the fact that there's a third party present, I think raises another issue. As to constructive possession, because that person had exclusive possession at that time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Getter, let's try this again, and we will start your time again from the beginning.
May I hand him his brief? Good morning again, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Matthew Getter on behalf of the United States. Let me take the arguments, if I may, in order of presentment by Mr. Lopez. The first argument he made concerned Carlos Villasenor. The issue really here is one of a fact, and the question is, was Carlos Villasenor cooperating with the government in connection with the charged case? Clearly, the evidence is that Mr. Carlos Villasenor was cooperating vis-a-vis Wilfredo Rodriguez, but that he provided no information and no assistance to the government in connection with the defendants who went to trial here, namely Mahin Villasenor, Joaquin Mendez, and Mr. Rodriguez. So the issue then is, under 801D2E, was he a conspirator in this conspiracy, and were his statements made during the course of and in furtherance of this conspiracy. And all the evidence suggests that Carlos Villaseñor was a participant in the charged conspiracy, even though he was cooperating in connection with someone else. And I take issue with Mr. Lopez's statement that once a cooperator, always a cooperator, because clearly Carlos Villaseñor was playing both sides here. And the fact that he was participating in this charged conspiracy means that the statements he made during the course of and in furtherance of that conspiracy are admissible. I would also add, as Judge Williams pointed out, that there was a timing issue as well. The fact that that Carlos Villaseñor was cooperating with the DEA from April 25th of 2003 to June 6th of 2003, but none of his admitted statements were made during that several weeks of time. The second argument Mr. Lopez made concerned Anthony Harris. And as the government has made clear to this court as well as to the district court, we concede the information was favorable and that it was suppressed, although not intentionally, as Mr. Lopez as well as the district court concluded. The question then is whether the information was material. And there are several reasons why the district court was correct in concluding that the information was not material. For one thing, the evidence against Mejin Villaseñor was overwhelming. This was a four-week trial with many, many intercepted conversations that were played, many of which Mejin Villaseñor was a participant in. There were multiple drug seizures. One of the seizures in January of 2003 of 2 kilos of cocaine had Mr. Mejin Villaseñor's fingerprints on them.
Lopez points out, though, that there were a large number of acquittals on certain counts.
As I recall, Your Honor, the acquittals pertained to one particular deal. That was a January 24th, 2003 deal where there was no seizure of drugs that day. And as best as I can infer from the jury's opinion, the fact that no drugs were seized that day and the evidence was a little bit less overwhelming as for that particular deal probably contributed to the jury's conclusion.
Was it any difference in the drugs? I think there were marijuana and cocaine here.
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the January 24th deal dealt with cocaine. I don't recall marijuana being an issue in January 24. But the January 10 deal, the February 21st or 22nd deal, and the March 21st deal were all cocaine. They were all multiple kilos of cocaine. And all I can say is that perhaps our evidence was so good as to those transactions that by comparison, the somewhat less evidence as to the January 24th is what swayed the jury there. You had cooperator testimony, surveillance testimony. There was so much evidence against Mejin Villaseñor. Throw in the fact that the scale in question here was recovered in Mr. Mendez's apartment, a co-defendant. In addition to the scale that was found in Mr. Mendez's apartment, there was also a gun that was found and ledgers that were concluded by an expert to be drug ledgers. So as the district court pointed out, even without findings of cocaine, trace residue cocaine, on the scale, you still had sufficient indicia of the fact that his co-defendant, Mr. Mendez, was himself a cocaine dealer. So the district court was correct in concluding there was more than enough evidence for the jury to have concluded that that Mejin Villaseñor was a participant in this conspiracy regardless of Mr. Harris's findings. And the difference, Chief Judge Easterbrook pointed out, between this case and the Banks decision was that in this case the scale subsequently was retested, which eliminates any doubt as to whether if this information had been disclosed and the defense had been aware of it, whether they could have called their own expert to show that there wasn't any cocaine on the scale. They could not have done that. The third argument Mr. Lopez raised dealt with the presence of the gun in Mr. Villaseñor's apartment. There is sufficient evidence, the government maintains, that the gun was in the constructive possession of Mr. Villaseñor, because it was a two-bedroom apartment. The gun was found in the master bedroom. The second bedroom, the testimony is, was a child's bedroom. And yes, while Mr. Villaseñor was not home that day, he had left for Texas about a week earlier. There's really, given the fact that the evidence is that Mr. Bill Snure was dealing in drugs, and there was some evidence, testimony presented by Agent Derbis, that guns are a tool of the drug trade, that there was enough evidence for the jury to have concluded that it was Mr. Villasenor's gun. There was also evidence in the apartment that it was Mr. Villasenor's apartment, a pay stub with his name on it, and tax documents containing his and his wife's names. Mr. Lopez mentioned that there was someone else who had access to the apartment. I believe the testimony was that there was an older woman on a lower floor of the apartment building who provided a key to the agents to execute the search warrant. Mr. Villasenor, I don't believe, addressed the issue of the buyer-seller relationship, so unless the court has any questions for me on that issue, I will not address that issue. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your time, and the government respectfully requests that the conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Getter. Anything further, Mr. Lopez?
If I can just say two things really quick, Judge. The buyer-seller agreement, it looks like after Villar, things might be changing a little bit. Maybe in the future this might not be the perfect case for it. But in this particular case, you have a loose-knit group of wholesalers and retailers with people providing drugs from the wholesale level to the retail level, and then the retailers taking it with their own organizations, their own groups, and their own distinctive customers doing their own thing. So we believe it is a buyer-seller relationship. And second, Your Honors, in regard to constructive possession, somebody else provided a key. Someone allowed them access to it. We know that there were co-occupants in this apartment based on the record. The defendant lived there with his wife. It could be either theirs, both of theirs, or none of theirs. And I think that raises a sufficient reasonable doubt in regard to the constructive possession issue. If Maheen had been outside the premises, seated in a car near the location, or the agents who had a lot of surveillance in this case had observed Mr. Villasenor walking out of the house, executed the search warrant, I think the case would be much stronger for the government at that point in time. But here you have an individual who's in another state approximately a week before that. You have another person who has a key to the premises. We have two people sharing occupancy in that particular premise. There's no question this court has held time and time again that guns are a tool of the trade. We understand that. We understand that. But this goes to the question of proof. Could the defendant constructively possess this weapon from as far away as Texas? And we believe that he could not. And again, the jury did look at all of the evidence in this case. There were these acquittals that were mentioned by the government just now. The one transaction was a multi-kilo transaction. There was no seizure. However, there was a lot of discussion. There was a lot of tapes. There was a lot of surveillance on that particular transaction. Talk about Harris, just adding Harris into the mixture. Had the defense been allowed to cross-examine Harris in our closing argument, we've been able to attack more of the reasonable doubt. Our job is to attack the government's proof. Our job is to attack and make the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody is guilty of a particular crime. And we need all the tools that we can to do that. And in order to receive a fair trial, we need those types of things. We need that type of impeachment that we can rely on. Again, Your Honors, these cases are very, very difficult from a defense point of view. We have a lot of drug cases in our district. As hard as we try, we need more tools. And the tools that allow us to do this is impeachment of certain government witnesses. And I think this stuff was important. Maybe it wouldn't have altered the outcome of the trial, but it sure would have given us some other arguments to present to this jury, who evidently was listening pretty tentatively to the testimony of all the witnesses. It's not the fact that there was cocaine. It's the fact of the inattention to duty and the discipline of that particular witness. Thank you, and I apologize again, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Lopez. The case is taken under advisement.